When he became Chief Justice in 1986, Rehnquist arrived with one great advantage. He wasn't Warren Burger. In his 17 years as chief, Burger had managed to alienate all of his colleagues. The greatest breach, and the most surprising, was with Harry Blackmun. No closer friends had ever served together on the court. They had met in kindergarten in St. Paul, Minnesota, and grown up together. In 1933, Blackmun was best man at Burger's wedding. Burger made his name first in national politics, serving in a senior post in the Eisenhower Justice Department, and he engineered both his own and then Blackmun's appointment to the Federal Court of Appeals. Burger became Chief Justice in 1969, and a year later, after the nominations of Clement Haynsworth and G. Harold Carswell failed, Burger inveigled President Nixon to name Blackmun in their place. In their early days on the court, the two men were known as the Minnesota Twins. The relationship soon soured. In part, the differences between the two men were simply ideological, as Blackmun moved closer to Brennan and Marshall on the left. But it was more the way Burger ran the court that came to madden Blackmun and his colleagues. The main duty of a Chief Justice is to chair the court's conference every Friday when it is in session. At those secret meetings, held in the Chief's conference room, the nine justices review the argued cases and cast their votes. When he is in the majority, the Chief Justice assigns who will write the opinion for the court. When the Chief is in dissent, the senior associate justice in the majority makes the assignment. The problem, it seemed, was that Burger could not run the conference. Discussions meandered aimlessly and ended inconclusively. Justices sometimes thought that Burger would switch his vote to keep control of opinions or even try to assign cases when he was not in the majority. William O. Douglas, then the senior associate justice, thought that was how Burger assigned Blackmun to write Roe v. Wade. Potter Stewart, who was appointed by Eisenhower in 1958, grew so frustrated with Burger that he took an unprecedented form of revenge. Stewart responded eagerly to an approach from Bob Woodward, who had just become famous for his work on Watergate, letting the journalist know he would cooperate with an extended investigation of the Burger court. Stewart's interviews provided a basis for The Brethren, written by Woodward and Scott Armstrong and published in 1979. The book, full of vivid inside detail that had never before been divulged to the public, portrayed Burger as a pompous, egomaniacal bumbler. Stewart wound up resigning in 1981 at the unusually young age of 66, opening the seat that went to O'Connor. Rehnquist never went public with his distress about Burger, but he also seethed. In the Burger years, opinions came out late or not at all, forcing cases to be put over or re-argued in subsequent years. Once, when Lewis Powell was ill, Rehnquist wrote him about his frustration with Burger. Powell, who joined the court at the age of 64, served as a kind of older brother to all the justices, and Rehnquist felt comfortable unburdening himself in alternately brusque and whimsical ways. Rehnquist wrote, "Sometimes when Burger runs out of things to say, but he doesn't want to give up the floor, he gives the impression of a Southern senator conducting a filibuster. I sometimes wish that neither the chief nor Bill Brennan would write out all their remarks beforehand and deliver them verbatim from the written page." "Bill is unusually thorough," Rehnquist went on, "but as often as not sounds like someone reading aloud a rather long and uninteresting recipe. Then, of course, Harry Blackmun can usually find two or three sinister aspects of every case which disturb him, although they have nothing to do with the merits of the question. And John Stevens today, as always, felt very strongly about every case, and Mirabile dictu had found just the right solution to every one. As you might imagine, my conference discussion was, as always, perfectly suited to the occasion, well-researched, cogently presented, and right on target." So when Rehnquist became chief in 1986, Burger had provided him with a clear picture of how not to run a conference. Rehnquist set out to do it differently, and he led by example. He would begin by briefly summarizing the case, giving his own view of the proper result, and then going around the table in order of seniority. The other justices followed his example. Their comments were shorter. The resolution of the cases was clearer. No one spoke twice before everyone had a chance to speak once. In time, the brevity of the conferences would come to have a large and unexpected impact on the workings of the court, but for the moment, everyone was pleased with the efficiency. Case assignments changed, too. Every Chief Justice wields power through assigning big cases to his favorites, or especially to himself. But Rehnquist made the system as fair as possible. No one received a new assignment until he or she had finished the previous one. As with speaking at conference, every justice was assigned one case before anyone was assigned two. Rehnquist didn't interfere with assignments when he was in the minority. Everyone on the court, liberals and conservatives alike, welcomed the changes. One of the signatures of the Berger years was that the court decided more and more cases every year. The number of filings increased, but the number of cases accepted jumped even faster. By the mid-1980s, they were hearing as many as 150 cases a year, double the number from the 1950s. Like the chaotic conferences, the ever-rising number of lawsuits contributed to an atmosphere of chaos. In those jumbled final days of the term each year, Berger often couldn't corral five justices to agree on a majority opinion. The splintered justices would thus fail to settle the issue before them and therefore offer little guidance to the lower courts addressing similar questions. At a basic level of competence, the court wasn't doing its job. For the most part, the justices controlled their calendar. They could decide how many cases to hear simply by granting or refusing writs of certiorari. Four votes are needed to grant a writ to hear a case. As it happened, White and Blackmun had idiosyncratic views of the certiorari process. White thought the court should grant cert whenever there was even a suggestion that two circuit courts of appeals viewed an issue differently. Other justices thought it necessary only to resolve significant circuit splits. Blackmun regarded a denial of cert as tantamount to a decision on the merits, so he wanted to grant whenever he disagreed with a lower court's view. White and Blackmun's approaches, plus various combinations of others, meant that the caseload was becoming close to unmanageable. By the time Berger resigned, all of the remaining justices wanted to reduce the number of cases, but how to do it in a way that wouldn't also take away their opportunity to advocate their own quirky views of the cert process. In a little noticed development, Rehnquist figured out a solution. One area the justices all wanted to pare was so-called mandatory appeals. Certain federal laws, mostly in obscure areas, gave the parties the absolute right to have their cases heard by the Supreme Court. These cases, which amounted to a dozen or more every year, absorbed a lot of the court's time on trivial issues. So Rehnquist lobbied Congress to change the law. The task required just the kind of Washington savvy that Berger claimed to have but didn't. Rehnquist accomplished his mission in just 2 years. In 1988, Congress passed a law that essentially gave the Supreme Court complete control of its docket. To a person, the justices were extremely grateful to the chief. Rehnquist's personality also changed the atmosphere at the court. Berger was an Anglophile who collected antiques and fine wines. When Blackmun joined the court, Berger gave him a top hat as a gift. Such was Berger's vanity that he placed a large cushion on the center seat on the bench so he would appear taller than his colleagues. Rehnquist had none of these pretensions, at least not in his early years as chief. He had a single beer and one cigarette at lunch every day. Later, he struggled with intermittent success to quit smoking and switched to what he would always call a Miller's Light. By the time he became chief, Rehnquist had pared his long sideburns and dropped the wide ties that were his concessions to 1970s fashion, but he still cut a shambling figure when he took his lunchtime strolls around the neighborhood. John Dean, Nixon's White House counsel, remembered that when he first introduced Rehnquist to the president, the then Assistant Attorney General was wearing a pink shirt that clashed with an awful psychedelic necktie and hush puppies. According to the White House tapes, after Rehnquist left, Nixon asked Dean, quote, "Is he Jewish? He looks it. That's a hell of a costume he's wearing, just like a clown," unquote. As chief, Rehnquist, a Lutheran of Swedish ancestry, disposed of the worst of his ties, but kept the hush puppies. For a large, strapping man, Rehnquist had a delicate constitution. He had a chronically bad back from an injury he sustained while gardening, and the pain would sometimes cause him to stand up during oral arguments at the court and take a few steps behind his chair. In the early 1980s, he was even hospitalized for the back problems, and the treatment created new issues. The painkillers caused him to slur his words, and the problem became embarrassingly noticeable when he asked questions in court. The FBI investigation in connection with his promotion to Chief Justice revealed that Rehnquist's medical problems were more serious than the public was led to believe. He had been addicted to the sedative Placidil for at least 4 years, and when he was hospitalized during withdrawal from the medication in 1981, he suffered hallucinations. On one occasion, he told a nurse that, quote, "voices outside the room are saying they're going to kill the president," unquote. Still, by the time he became chief in 1986, his condition appears to have stabilized, in part because he took up tennis. Even though he was entitled to hire 4 law clerks, he generally took only 3, which suited his weekly doubles game. Rehnquist had married his wife, Natalie Cornell, known as Nan, after his service in World War II. A native of Wisconsin, Rehnquist had developed a taste for desert heat during his time as a weather spotter in North Africa, and the newlyweds settled in Phoenix. The chief's military service also instilled in him a lifelong curiosity about the weather that matched his interest in low-stakes gambling. He'd often bet his law clerks how much snow had fallen in the plaza in front of the court. Nan matched her husband in a mutual absence of pretensions, and their marriage was long and happy. But shortly after Rehnquist became chief, Nan was diagnosed with cancer. Their struggle with her illness, combined with the markedly improved atmosphere at the court, only deepened the affection of Rehnquist's colleagues for him. She died on October 17, 1991. That was just 2 days after Thomas, at long last, won confirmation in the Senate. But the tally of votes on October 15th didn't conclude the drama surrounding Thomas's nomination. Hill's testimony had set off a furious scramble among many journalists and Democratic activists to corroborate or refute her charges. Records of Thomas's videotape rentals were of particular interest. Rumors abounded that other women were going to come forward with evidence of objectionable behavior by Thomas. Even though he'd been confirmed, Thomas would not have become a justice, and thus removable only by impeachment by the House and conviction by the Senate, until he took the oath of office. But before the furor over Hill erupted, the White House and Rehnquist had tentatively planned for Thomas to take it from the Chief Justice on November 1st. But that was 17 full days after the Senate vote, a period of time when anything could happen. Thomas's supporters wanted him sworn in immediately. But with Nan Rehnquist's death on October 17th, the White House faced the delicate problem of intruding on the Chief Justice's grief for a final act of damage control on Thomas's nomination. At first, it tried to finesse the problem by holding an unofficial swearing-in, a party in effect, on the White House lawn on Friday, October 18th. The ceremony would have no legal significance, but it would contribute to an atmosphere of finality around the confirmation. Hundreds of guests, including many members of Thomas's family, including his father, from whom he had long been estranged until shortly before his nomination, and celebrities like Sylvester Stallone and Reggie Jackson, joined the president to salute the new justice. Still, Thomas was not yet an actual member of the court, and investigative reporters were still hard at work. White House officials decided the stakes were high enough to risk offending Rehnquist, so they asked him to administer the oath to Thomas only days after Nan Rehnquist's death. The chief agreed, and the swearing-in took place on October 23rd in a conference room at the court, the first such private ceremony in 50 years. The official explanation for the speeded-up procedure was to allow Thomas's secretaries and clerks to get on the Supreme Court payroll. a transparent rationalization, since his employees were already on the federal payroll at the D.C. Circuit. The rushed oath turned out to be a wise move. That same day, according to Jane Mayer and Jill Abramson, three reporters from the Washington Post burst into the newsroom almost simultaneously with information confirming that Thomas's involvement with pornography far exceeded what the public had been led to believe. They had testimony from eyewitnesses and the manager of a video store where Thomas rented such fare. But since Thomas had been sworn in, the Post decided not to pursue the issue and dropped the story. The whole Thomas confirmation could scarcely have been a greater assault on the court's sense of seemliness. The crudity of the accusations, the brutality of Thomas's response, the vindictive discourse on all sides made for a perfectly awful combination. That the White House, if not Thomas himself, had intruded on Rehnquist's grieving for political purposes made it even worse. O'Connor, who was considered the social as well as the political center of the court, had a habit of dividing the world, people, buildings, controversies, issues, into two categories, attractive and unattractive. The words referred not so much to what was or wasn't pleasing to the eye, but rather to an overall level of decency and likability. To her and her colleagues at the court, the Thomas hearings defined unattractive. Then it got worse. The November 11, 1991 issue of People magazine featured a 7-page spread on Clarence and Virginia Thomas and their view of the confirmation ordeal. Ginny Thomas was a political force in her own right, a Labor Department lawyer at the time, and later a senior official with the Republican congressional leadership and with conservative foundations. She said that after Hill made her claims, quote, "The Clarence Thomas I had married was nowhere to be found. He was just debilitated beyond anything I had seen in my life. Around 12:45 a.m., he said, 'I need you to call your two friends from your Bible study group and their husbands and get them here with me in the morning to pray.' Clarence knew that the next round of hearings to begin that day was not the normal political battle. It was spiritual warfare, good versus evil. We were fighting something we didn't understand, and we needed prayerful people in our lives. We needed God," Virginia Thomas had said. The couple posed for photographs, grinning cheek to cheek, holding hands on the plush carpet, curled up on the sofa reading the Bible. Thomas told the reporter, "It's been brutal, just brutal. I don't know if it's over, but we found a way to survive, and we have each other." The interview came at a time when the justices rarely said anything to the press, much less engaged in soul-bearing for People magazine. Justice Thomas's cooperation with the magazine was especially inappropriate because just a month earlier, he had refused to answer exactly these kinds of questions about his personal life before the Judiciary Committee. The People spread compounded the court's sense of bewilderment about him. Thomas moved into his chambers and heard nothing from his colleagues. In part, that was just the style of the Rehnquist court. The justices did not casually drop by one another's offices. At the D.C. Circuit and in his other government jobs, Thomas liked to wander the hall, shoot the breeze, and make spur-of-the-moment lunch plans, but that simply wasn't done at the court. He met his new colleagues at conference, where they greeted him cordially, but their interaction stopped there. For Thomas, the silence in his chambers was deafening. So Thomas retreated. Two of the first decorating touches on the bare walls of his office were telling. In the entrance foyer, he posted an admonition to respect the confidentiality of all Supreme Court business. On the door to his private office, he put the words, "Do not disturb." He used to enjoy taking lunchtime walks around the D.C. Circuit Courthouse, but his notoriety made anonymity impossible. He even stopped driving his beloved black Corvette to work. Quote, "Res ipsa," unquote, the vanity license plate read, a play on the Latin legal phrase that means "the thing speaks for itself." The car was too recognizable. Thomas told the docket sheet, the Supreme Court's internal newsletter, in the only interview he gave after People, I used to love to walk out with my clerks and walk down to the old post office and have barbecue or something like that, or walk over to Union Station and have cheese fries or something. My total loss of anonymity has been a big change in that regard. In one respect, it was fortunate that Thomas almost never left the Supreme Court building by foot in his first year, because it meant that he probably never saw the boldly lettered graffito on a Capitol Hill sidewalk across the street. It said, "Anita told the truth." Unlike most of his fellow justices, Thomas made an effort to learn the names of the people who worked at the court, the cafeteria workers, clerks, and cops. Despite his friendly demeanor, the court employees saw how devastated he was by the confirmation battle. Years later, Thomas recalled that one of the Supreme Court police officers who noticed how battered and beaten he looked took to welcoming him each day with the words, "Don't let them take your joy." Just weeks after joining the court, Thomas had a chance to strike back at the "them" who had tormented him in the hearings. The question before him, should Roe v. Wade be overruled? There were two kinds of cases before the Supreme Court. There were abortion cases, and there were all the others. Abortion was and remains the central legal issue before the court. It defined the judicial philosophies of the justices. It dominated the nomination and confirmation process. It nearly delineated the difference between the national Democratic and Republican parties. And in 1992, the issue and the court appeared to be at a turning point. For the first time since Roe v. Wade was decided 19 years earlier, 8 of the 9 justices on the court had been appointed by Republicans, whose party was publicly and officially committed to ending legalized abortion. And the single Democratic appointee, Byron White, who was named by John F. Kennedy in 1962, had dissented in Roe and voted against abortion rights in every subsequent case. If there was ever a perfect opportunity to overturn Roe once and for all, the spring of 1992 was it. Unlike other branches of the government, the courts, even justices of the Supreme Court, cannot simply decide to take action on an issue of importance to them. They must wait until a case happens to move through the lower courts in a way that raises the issue. Savvy lawyers can shape the process. Indeed, as the court became more conservative in the Berger years, certain liberal civil rights groups would sometimes actually put up money to pay off plaintiffs in controversial cases, so that the justices would not decide the case and create a bad precedent. But sometimes the interests aligned so that a major issue landed in the court at the most dramatic possible time. That was what happened right after Thomas joined the court. In the years since Roe, states with anti-abortion majorities had tried in different ways to pass restrictive laws that the Supreme Court would approve. The laws tracked the evolution of the court. As the court became more conservative, the states became bolder in tightening the restrictions. Anticipating the court's move to the right on abortion, and hoping to push it further in that direction, Pennsylvania had passed one of the nation's most restrictive laws in 1989. The law forced women who wanted abortions to wait 24 hours after contacting a clinic before getting abortions, and mandated that women be given a lecture about fetal development and alternatives to abortion. Minors seeking abortions would have to get permission from a parent or a judge, and married women would have to inform their husbands of their plans. On October 21, 1991, 6 days after Thomas was confirmed and 2 days before he was sworn in, a 3-judge panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit upheld the Pennsylvania law almost in its entirety. The majority in Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania v. Governor Robert P. Casey rejected only one part of the law, the provision mandating that married women must first inform their husbands if they sought an abortion. Most married women will discuss the abortion decision with their husbands, the majority said, but some married women would not, because many husbands are capable of violence in circumstances of this kind and will use physical force and the threat thereof to keep the wife from access to the clinic. The third judge on the Third Circuit panel disagreed, arguing that he would have upheld the spousal notification requirement along with the rest of the law. That third judge, Samuel A. Alito Jr., had just been appointed to the bench a year earlier by President George H.W. Bush, and this was his first major opinion. He was only 41 years old, a former federal prosecutor and Justice Department official who could expect serious scrutiny as a possible Supreme Court candidate down the line. Like all such judges, Alito knew that he would be in great measure defined by how he ruled on abortion. So the case was of no small consequence, and unlike the other judges on the panel, Alito didn't split the difference. He supported all of Pennsylvania's restrictions, including the requirement that women notify their spouses in advance before obtaining an abortion. Spousal notification would affect very few women in Pennsylvania, Alito said. The evidence in the case showed that between 70 and 80% of women who sought abortions were unmarried, and 95% of married women who sought abortions did tell their husbands. Thus, it is immediately apparent, Alito wrote, that the law cannot affect more than about 5% of married women seeking abortions, or an even smaller percentage of all women desiring abortions. In light of these small numbers, he wrote, there was no broad practical impact needed to establish an undue burden. In one important respect, the three Third Circuit judges agreed. By 1992, Roe v. Wade was still nominally the leading Supreme Court case on abortion rights, but the Third Circuit scarcely paid any attention to Harry Blackmun's venerable landmark. Rather, its judges concluded that the views of a different justice represented the true center of the court. Their opinions represented their best efforts at speculating how this justice, Sandra O'Connor, would view the case. When it came to abortion rights, even at the start of the 1990s, the Rehnquist Court was in fact the O'Connor Court. After blazing through Stanford Law School and graduating in 1952, O'Connor did not receive a single job offer as a lawyer. The major Los Angeles law firm of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher said she could come to work as a legal secretary. But O'Connor ignored the slights, as became her custom, and concentrated instead on building a life with her new husband, John. He graduated from Stanford Law a year after she did, and following his army stint in Germany, they settled in the booming but still very small city of Phoenix. The next years passed in a blur, which was the pace of life O'Connor preferred. She had three boys in 6 years. She worked at a small law firm, then as an assistant attorney general. She volunteered for local hospitals and the Salvation Army and worked her way up the hierarchy at the Junior League. She and John, who became a successful lawyer himself, hosted lively barbecues for dozens of people, often including Bill and Nan Rehnquist, at their adobe home in Paradise Valley. Once, according to her biographer Joan Biskupic, the O'Connors staged a campy dedication party for a bridge they had built over their backyard pool. Men wore top hats and tails, with white shorts and sneakers, and women sported gowns and pith helmets. Boiled beef, potatoes, and English muffins were served, and bagpipes provided accompaniment. Much later, in her chambers at the Supreme Court, O'Connor would demand that her law clerks replicate her own headlong style of living. Marriage, children, career, exercise, culture, politics, volunteer work. She had done it all, and everyone else should too. Female clerks were required to join her 3 mornings a week exercise class at the court gym. Late in her tenure, she added salsa dancing to the workouts. Male clerks planning weddings were ordered to get in shape. One stuffed an ice cream cone in his desk drawer so she wouldn't see it. Clerks dozing from exhaustion would be instructed to join her at special private showings at the National Gallery. An annual clerk's picnic by the cherry blossoms in the tidal basin would and often did take place even in the rain. For O'Connor, even holidays were occasions for exertion. For Halloween, she demanded that her clerks decorate a pumpkin with a newsy theme. After 9/11, there was Osama bin Pumpkin. A year later, a Martha Stewart pumpkin wearing prison garb. The formative political event of O'Connor's years in Phoenix took place in 1969 when her local state senator moved to Washington to take a job in the Nixon administration. Though she had been an assistant attorney general for only 4 years, and women politicians were still a novelty, she persuaded the governor, Jack Williams, to appoint her to fill the seat. O'Connor took to legislative work immediately, building coalitions, making deals, pushing bills through the process. The job suited her personality. She got along with people and liked to get things done. O'Connor came of age when Barry Goldwater dominated the Arizona Republican Party, and she supported him for president in 1964, but her work in politics never had a particularly ideological edge. Fittingly, one of the first bills she sponsored was to repeal a 1913 law that prohibited women from working more than 8 hours a day. To O'Connor, this was paternalism, not protection. O'Connor took the same pragmatic approach to the subject of abortion, displaying the kind of artful political tacking on the issue that she would show on the court. She had taken office when a drive was on to change abortion laws in the state legislatures, and Arizona was no exception. At the time she became a senator, Arizona law prohibited abortions except to save a woman's life, and the following year, 1970, a liberalization bill came before a committee where O'Connor served. On April 29, 1970, according to local newspapers, she voted to end criminal prohibitions on abortions in Arizona. The measure passed the committee, but never came up for a vote of the full Senate. While she supported that pro-choice measure, she also backed a restriction on abortion rights in the form of a law that would have allowed only licensed physicians to perform abortions. Shortly after O'Connor became majority leader of the Senate, Roe v. Wade made these initial rounds of legislative approaches moot. Abortion would be legal regardless of what the state legislatures did. In Arizona, at least, since the right to choose abortion was now protected by the U.S. Constitution, the issue faded from the state's immediate political agenda. In a curious postscript, O'Connor's record on abortion rights was a focus of the vetting process when Reagan was considering naming her to the court in 1981. O'Connor told the vetter, a young Justice Department aide named Kenneth Starr, that she had never cast a vote on the abortion liberalization measure. Starr took her word for it, and no one else thought to check the Phoenix papers for a record of her vote. The scrutiny of Supreme Court nominees became much closer in later years. The omission allowed O'Connor to assure the Reagan team that she personally opposed abortion at the same time as she left a studied ambiguity about how she felt about the legal status of abortion rights. In truth, it seemed, O'Connor never gave abortion rights a great deal of attention as a legislator. To the extent she thought about abortion, she tried to steer a middle course between extremes on the issue, an approach that would remain her touchstone in the infinitely higher stakes setting of the Supreme Court. As the lawyers in the Casey case turned their attention from the Third Circuit to the Supreme Court, the counsel for the plaintiffs had politics as much as law on her mind. Like all other Supreme Court practitioners, Catherine Colbert, the ACLU attorney who had shepherded the litigation through the Third Circuit, knew O'Connor's penchant for the middle ground, but the lawyer wanted to take that option away. Colbert thought that it was time to challenge the Supreme Court and the American electorate, so she devised one of the most audacious litigation tactics in Supreme Court history. By the time the Third Circuit decided Casey, Colbert and her colleagues thought that the protections of Roe v. Wade had been whittled away for so long that it was better for their cause to have the precedent reversed once and for all. Colbert wanted the Supreme Court to decide Casey and presumably overturn Roe before the 1992 election. That way, there would be no doubt about the stakes for future Supreme Court appointments. Colbert had to move fast. After the decision by the three-judge panel of the Third Circuit on October 21, 1991, the ACLU could have petitioned all of the judges on that court to rehear the case en banc. That would have taken months. Alternatively, the Supreme Court rules gave her side 90 days until mid-January 1992 to file a petition for a writ of certiorari. A petition submitted at that time probably would not have been acted upon until late spring, so the case would not have been argued until the fall of 1992 and the decision handed down in 1993. Too late. To place the fate of Roe before the voters in time for the next election, Colbert had to figure out a way to have the case argued and decided by the end of the 1991 term. That is, by June 1992. It took Colbert just 3 weeks until November 7th to file her cert petition. According to the Supreme Court rules, the party seeking review in the court begins its brief with a section called Questions Presented. The art in writing these questions is to frame the issue in a way that will make at least four justices inclined to take the case. But Colbert was writing for a broader audience than the court itself, so she crafted the single question in the most provocative way she could. Quote, "Has the Supreme Court overruled Roe v. Wade, holding that a woman's right to choose abortion is a fundamental right protected by the United States Constitution?" Unquote. It didn't take a law degree to understand that on the eve of the 1992 election, the future of Roe was now squarely before the court. Colbert's strategy of forcing the court to rule before the election was so transparent that it offended Chief Justice Rehnquist. He didn't like the idea of the courts being used as a pawn in political debate, and he didn't care for litigants trying to game the court's schedule either. So, the liberals on the court believed, Rehnquist struck back. Using the powers of the Chief Justice, he simply kept Planned Parenthood v. Casey off the list of cert petitions that the justices would consider in their weekly conference. Rehnquist saw that the case was relisted and thus unresolved. Rehnquist was running out the clock. Harry Blackmun, whose entire tenure on the court was coming down to a defense of his opinion in Roe, was furious, as were his law clerks. In an unusual joint memorandum, they wrote to Blackmun, "We strongly feel that the case should be heard this spring. If you believe that there are enough votes on the court now to overrule Roe, it would be better to do it this year before the election and give women the opportunity to vote their outrage." But how to do it? How could Blackmun and the pro-choice justices force Casey onto the court's calendar? John Paul Stevens figured out the answer. Stevens' reserved manner and penchant for writing solo dissents and concurrences sometimes gave the impression that his iconoclasm equaled a lack of influence. But his raw intelligence and knowledge of the court's rules, along with his willingness to stroke the bigger egos of his colleagues, gave him a crucial advantage. To break the logjam on Casey, Stevens threatened to write a dissenting opinion on Rehnquist's decision to relist the case. Blackmun said he would join Stevens in the public protest. Relisting was usually a purely procedural matter utterly unfamiliar to the general public. As far as anyone could tell, no justice had ever written an opinion dissenting from a relisting. That was the point. Stevens knew that to write one now and to accuse Rehnquist of stalling because of abortion politics in a presidential election would create a sensation. Rehnquist, ever mindful of protecting the court's reputation as well as his own, backed down. He agreed to put the case on the calendar, and on January 21, 1992, the court announced that it would hear the Casey appeal on April 22nd, the final day of argument for the term and the last chance to have the case decided by Election Day. At the conference where the justices agreed to take Casey, David Souter pointed out that there was still one more matter to settle. The court often adopted the questions presented in the brief of the appealing party, but Souter didn't like the provocative one that Colbert had submitted. In a memo to his colleague, Souter said, "I suggested that the question be rephrased." Souter didn't want to acknowledge that the only choice in Casey was to make an up or down judgment on Roe. He wanted the flexibility to rule on the specifics of the Pennsylvania statute without necessarily passing on the ultimate issue of Roe v. Wade. In his memo, Souter proposed that a question be added specifically addressing the issue of precedent. What weight is due to considerations of stare decisis in evaluating the constitutional right to abortion? Stare decisis, which means to stand by that which is decided, is the Latin term for the rule of precedent. Souter's colleagues ultimately decided not to use his question, preferring instead to list each provision of the Pennsylvania law and ask whether each was constitutional. but Souter's question still turned out to be the most important one in the case. Few justices had rockier debuts than David Souter. He was sworn in on October 8, 1990, a week after the court's term started, and he never managed to catch up with the work his first year. By the spring of 1991, months had passed without an opinion from him. Finally, he delivered 6 opinions in the final month, but overall his performance had been embarrassing. At least in that first term, the Republicans who supported Souter had reason to be pleased, for his record was decidedly conservative. He had joined Rehnquist and Scalia in most of the big cases that year, including one that touched on abortion. In Rust v. Sullivan, he cast the key vote in a 5-4 decision that upheld the so-called abortion gag rule, which forbade doctors who received federal funds from even mentioning abortion to their patients. At first, Souter's eccentricities drew more notice around the court than his jurisprudence. 52 years old and a lifelong bachelor, he had the habits of a gentleman from another century. During the day, he would leave the lights off in his office and maneuver his chair around the room reading briefs by the sun. He ate the same thing for lunch every day, an entire apple, including the core and seeds, with a cup of yogurt. When the justices sat together in their dining room, the two items would be delivered to Souter on the same fine china that served his colleagues. Souter was familiar with Coca-Cola, but he had never heard of a beverage that several of the other justices favored, Diet Coke. Souter did all his writing by fountain pen. Perhaps the best-known fact about the new justice was that when Warren Rudman, the New Hampshire senator who was Souter's friend and patron, gave Souter his first television set, he apparently never plugged it in. By the end of Souter's first term, there was some sentiment around the court that he was overwhelmed by his new job. Souter almost said as much in the customary first interview with the court's in-house publication, The Docket Sheet. "I really see myself less as working than as trying to keep from being inundated by the flow of things to be done," he said. Somebody used the phrase that coming here is like walking through a tidal wave, and it is. When the term ended in June 1991, Souter did not so much leave Washington as flee. He returned to the converted farmhouse in Weir, New Hampshire that had been his grandparents' home and where he had grown up. Contrary to rumor, Souter did not live with his mother. She had moved elsewhere. The swirl of events leading to his appointment had deprived him of the time to think about the magnitude of the task before him. In a letter declining an invitation from Blackmun to join him on his annual summer trip to Aspen, Souter wrote, "I have wanted as much as possible to be alone, to come to terms in my own heart with what has been happening to me. I have also felt the need to engage in some reading and thinking about matters that will be coming before the court." He wanted his summers, he wrote later, "wholly free for self-education. I need some period of the year when I can make a close approach to solitude." When Souter returned the following fall for his second term, the year of Casey, it became clear both that he had been underestimated in Washington and that he brought a distinctive judicial philosophy to the bench. For most of the 20th century, the political left and right had their clear judicial analogs on the Supreme Court. In rough terms, William Brennan and his allies used the Constitution as a vehicle for liberal change, to build a society with greater freedom and equality. On the other side, Rehnquist and Scalia generally put forth the view that courts should defer to political majorities and legislators and interpret the Constitution in line with the original intent of the framers. There was, however, a third tradition in American law, which was less familiar to the public because, unlike the others, it did not neatly reflect the division between the Democratic and Republican parties. But it was to this third tradition that David Souter belonged. At his confirmation hearings in 1990, Souter made his affiliation plain. At the time, Souter was widely regarded as a stealth candidate, because even though he had been Attorney General of New Hampshire and a Justice of the State Supreme Court, he had not taken public stands on the most controversial issues of the day, like abortion. Pro-choice advocacy groups assumed that as a justice, Souter would simply do the bidding of the contemporary Republican Party. As the National Organization for Women said in a leaflet distributed during his hearings, "Stop Souter or women will die. In those hearings, Souter did not so much take sides in the great legal debate of the day as puzzle the partisans on both sides. The hearings revealed that Souter had given deep thought to the Constitution and embraced a philosophy most closely associated with John Marshall Harlan II, who served on the Supreme Court from 1955 to 1971. Harlan, whose grandfather and namesake served on the court from 1877 to 1911, was hardly a radical liberal. Indeed, he dissented from many of the Warren Court's most celebrated rulings. But neither was Harlan exactly a conservative, at least in modern terms. He believed that law existed to preserve the stability of society, and that adherence to precedent best guaranteed a limited and predictable role for the judiciary. Above all, he believed in the rule of stare decisis. Like Harlan, Souter put his faith in the common law, the accumulated wisdom of judges and courts going back to the Middle Ages. Also like Harlan, Souter believed that the Constitution expressed a libertarian ideal, that freedom from the restrictions of government counted as much as, or more than, the right of legislators to pass laws limiting individual freedom. And the people's rights were not limited by the precise language of the Constitution either. One of the strongest arguments against so-called unenumerated rights in the Constitution is that a written document should be limited in meaning to its precise terms. In a famous dissenting opinion from 1961, Harlan rejected that view, stating that the full scope of liberty guaranteed by the Due Process Clause cannot be found in or limited by the precise terms of the specific guarantees elsewhere provided in the Constitution. This liberty is not a series of isolated points pricked out in terms of the taking of property, the freedom of speech, press, and religion, and so on. It is a rational continuum which, broadly speaking, includes a freedom from all substantial arbitrary impositions and purposeless restraints. Harlan's view on unenumerated rights had become a crucial intellectual building block in the court's future decisions recognizing the right to privacy and later, the right to abortion. For David Souter in 1992, the question was whether restrictions on the right to choose abortion were the kind of arbitrary imposition prohibited by the Constitution. The way that Souter addressed that kind of question was to look at the common law and precedent. Thus, his proposed question, the key issue in the case: what weight is due to considerations of stare decisis in evaluating the constitutional right to abortion? For Souter, the answer wouldn't just resolve Casey, but define his judicial worldview. Early in Rehnquist's tenure as Chief Justice, the court's oral arguments were transformed from the Berger years. Throughout the 80s, it was a quiet bench. Brennan, Marshall, and Blackmun asked hardly any questions, and Berger, White, and Powell only a few more. The change began when Scalia joined the court in 1986. His pugnacious wit and open partisanship raised the energy level in the courtroom, and lawyers soon could expect a hot bench on even the most arcane issues. One way O'Connor prepared for oral argument was to plan questions with her clerks, and she began a tradition of asking the first question of most lawyers. Rehnquist and Kennedy liked to talk, too, and the overall level of volubility on the court made what happened on April 22, 1992, so extraordinary. We'll next hear argument in number 91744, Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania v. Robert P. Casey, Rehnquist said in his familiar long-voweled Midwestern drawl. Miss Colbert? Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, whether our Constitution endows government with the power to force a woman to continue or to end a pregnancy against her will is the central question in this case, Colbert began. Since this court's decision in Roe v. Wade, a generation of American women have come of age secure in the knowledge that the Constitution provides the highest level of protection for their childbearing decisions. That was as long as the court allowed most advocates to speak without jumping in with questions. But there was only silence from the justices, so Colbert kept going. This landmark decision, which necessarily and logically flows from a century of this court's jurisprudence, not only protects the rights of bodily integrity and autonomy, but has enabled millions of women to participate fully and equally in society. The genius of Roe and the Constitution is that it fully protects rights of fundamental importance. Government may not chip away at fundamental rights, nor make them selectively available only to the most privileged women. More silence from the bench. A murmur began in the audience, a very knowledgeable group, especially in a big case like this one. Why weren't they asking questions? Why were they paralyzed? 3 minutes, 4 minutes, still no questions from the justices, and no retreat from Colbert. Her strategy was the same one in her brief. Go for broke, all or nothing, overturn the Pennsylvania regulations in their entirety, or overturn Roe v. Wade. Our nation's history and tradition also respects the autonomy of individuals to make life choices consistent with their own moral and conscientious beliefs, Colbert said. Our Constitution has long recognized an individual's right to make private and intimate decisions about marriage and family life, the upbringing of children, the ability to use contraception. The decision to terminate a pregnancy or to carry it to term is no different in kind. Finally, after 8 minutes, O'Connor spoke up in her characteristic sing-song earnestness, reminiscent of a nursery school teacher. Miss Colbert, you're arguing the case as if all we have before us is whether to apply stare decisis and preserve Roe v. Wade in all its aspects, she said. Nevertheless, we granted certiorari on some specific questions in the case. Do you plan to address any of those in your argument? Colbert replied, in so many words, no. She was not going to concede that the individual restrictions could be separated from the larger question of preserving Roe. Kennedy tried too. He said, you have a number of specific provisions here that I think you should address, but Colbert wouldn't yield. To her, ruling on Casey meant ruling on Roe. At the conference of the justices that week, the result was muddled. 7 justices, Rehnquist, White, O'Connor, Scalia, Kennedy, Souter, and Thomas, wanted to uphold most of Pennsylvania's restrictions on abortion. Only Stevens and Blackmun wanted to strike them down. But there were tensions within the majority. Rehnquist, White, and Scalia were on record wanting to overrule Roe. And Thomas, his confirmation uncertainty notwithstanding, wanted to join them. But there was not yet a 5th vote to overturn Roe outright. Neither O'Connor, Kennedy, nor Souter was ready to go that far. So, at the end of the conference, Rehnquist assigned Casey to himself, intending to write an opinion that allowed states almost a free hand in regulating abortion. As a practical matter, Roe would be overturned, but not in so many words. Then, early the following week, Souter decided to pay a visit to O'Connor. In his gentle way, Souter told O'Connor he was uncomfortable with the chief's approach in Casey. Couldn't they find a way to preserve the core of Roe while upholding most of the specific provisions of the Pennsylvania law at issue? Indeed, Souter said, O'Connor's own opinions pointed the way. O'Connor's views on the right to abortion grew out of the original decision in Roe. There, in 1973, Blackmun had written that the fundamental right to privacy is broad enough to encompass a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. But the right to abortion was not absolute. Where a state could show that there was a compelling state interest in limiting the right to choose abortion, the court would approve the restriction. To discern the state's interest in regulating abortion, Blackmun devised a framework that relied on pregnancy's trimester calendar. The justice canvassed the medical literature and determined that in the first trimester, the prospect of carrying a pregnancy through to childbirth was clearly more risky for a woman than an early-term abortion. Thus, he wrote, the state could not restrict abortion during this period, and the decision must be left to the medical judgment of the pregnant woman's attending physician. Much of the opinion in Roe was expressed in terms of the rights of the physician rather than those of the woman. As a former general counsel for the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, Blackmun had a high regard for the medical profession. But as the pregnancy continued, Blackman wrote, laws could reflect the government's interest in protecting the fetus, not just the woman's rights. After the first trimester, the state could regulate abortion, but only in ways that are reasonably related to maternal health. Finally, subsequent to viability, the state could restrict or even ban abortion, except when it is necessary for the preservation of the life or health of the mother. In essence, Roe introduced a sliding scale on which a woman's right to abortion was greatest earlier in her pregnancy and could be limited as the fetus grew. Even so, Blackman insisted any law restricting abortion, even late in a pregnancy, would have to ensure protection of not only a woman's life, but also her health. Blackman elaborated on this point in his lesser-known but still important opinion in Doe v. Bolton, a challenge to Georgia's abortion law, which was decided by the court on the same day as Roe. Again expressing the right to abortion as a doctor's choice, Blackman wrote that the decision to perform the procedure may be exercised in light of all factors: physical, emotional, psychological, familial, and the woman's age, relevant to the well-being of the patient. In other words, when a woman's health was at stake, at whatever stage of the pregnancy, she and her doctor should be able to choose abortion. O'Connor took an independent tack on abortion from the beginning of her tenure on the court. In her first important case on the subject in 1983, the majority struck down a set of rules in Akron, Ohio, that were clearly designed to discourage women from having abortions, including a regulation requiring that all abortions occurring after the first trimester take place in hospitals, and another calling for a 24-hour waiting period for women seeking abortions. O'Connor wrote a dissenting opinion in which she defended the regulations and attacked part of Blackman's logic in Roe v. Wade. Improvements in medical technology, O'Connor declared, would render the trimester analysis obsolete. Increasing numbers of premature infants would be able to survive birth at ever earlier stages of pregnancy, she argued, and women would be able to have safer abortions later in pregnancy. The Roe framework, then, is clearly on a collision course with itself, she continued in what became her most famous sentence as a justice. As the medical risks of various abortion procedures decrease, the point at which the state may regulate for reasons of maternal health is moved further forward to actual childbirth. As medical science becomes better able to provide for the separate existence of the fetus, the point of viability is moved further back towards conception. O'Connor proposed a new legal framework to replace Roe. Adopting a phrase contained in a brief filed in the case by President Reagan's Justice Department, she wrote that abortion regulations should be upheld unless they created an undue burden on a woman seeking to have the procedure. O'Connor didn't define exactly what she meant by an undue burden, but she argued that, according to such a standard, the Akron restriction should be upheld. In fact, when it came to medical care, Blackman turned out to be more prescient than O'Connor. She was wrong to conclude that the point of viability would shift in any meaningful way. In Roe, Blackman had written, viability is usually placed at about 7 months, 28 weeks, but may occur earlier, even at 24 weeks. Early in the 21st century, more than three decades after Roe, it is still rare for a fetus younger than 23 or 24 weeks to survive. The term of a normal pregnancy is 38 to 40 weeks. As usual when it came to controversial issues, O'Connor's preference was for the matter to be settled in the political arena rather than the courts. As a former state legislator herself, she always had a predisposition to favor the judgments of these officials. Quoting an opinion by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. from 1904, O'Connor wrote, "In determining whether the state imposes an undue burden, we must keep in mind, when we are concerned with extremely sensitive issues such as the one involved here, the appropriate forum for their resolution in a democracy is the legislature." But through her first decade on the court, even as O'Connor criticized Roe, she never called for its outright rejection. In 1989, the court came close to overturning Roe when it approved a Missouri law prohibiting most abortions in public hospitals. In Webster v. Reproductive Health Services, Rehnquist, joined by White, Scalia, and for the most part Kennedy, all but called for the end of Roe. But O'Connor, characteristically, held back, writing, "When the constitutional invalidity of a state's abortion statute actually turns upon the constitutional validity of Roe, there will be time enough to re-examine Roe and to do so carefully." This, then, was the state of O'Connor's thinking when Souter paid her his visit, opposed to Blackmun's reasoning in Roe, supportive of efforts by state legislators to limit abortion, cautious, as always, about getting out of step with public opinion. But time enough had passed. She had to take a stand on Roe. Even though the conference in Casey resulted in Rehnquist assigning himself the majority opinion, that didn't end the matter as far as Souter was concerned. He hated to see the court drawn so directly into a contested political issue. He believed, perhaps naively, that there was an island of law that could be insulated from the daily rush of events. It had been almost 20 years since Roe, and while the court had allowed states to regulate and limit abortion during that time, there had been little doubt that the Constitution forbade a complete prohibition on abortion. Yet Rehnquist's position at conference and the opinion he was writing would clearly permit a total ban. O'Connor agreed with Souter. She had a less mystical attachment to the idea of precedent than Souter did, but her more political instincts led her in the same direction. The country had come to terms with Roe. Something else was bothering O'Connor, too. She was appalled by the provision in the Pennsylvania law that required married women who were seeking abortions to inform their husbands. The Court of Appeals had struck down this provision, but Rehnquist proposed to uphold the view of the dissenting judge from the lower court. But that opinion, the one by Judge Samuel Alito, outraged O'Connor. She saw this provision as paternalism at best and sexism at worst. O'Connor had finely tuned radar for discrimination against women, something she sometimes lacked for bias against, say, African Americans, and she couldn't abide the notion that the court would uphold such a law. So Souter and O'Connor were aligned on the idea that the court should uphold what they came to call the essence of Roe, and they agreed that they should try to strike down the spousal notification provision. But they had only 4 votes for these positions, their own plus those of Blackmun and Stevens, who were ready to reject the whole Pennsylvania law. They knew that there was only one place to go for a possible 5th vote, the chambers of Tony Kennedy. Souter and Kennedy could hardly have approached the job of Supreme Court Justice more differently. Souter avoided attention, loathed controversy, and disliked high-profile cases. Kennedy relished his public role and sought out the opinions that would make the newspapers. Seated at his keyboard, typing furiously, Kennedy always labored most closely on the sections of opinions that might be quoted in the New York Times. If Souter thought the proper role for a judge was as the nearly silent steward of judicial tradition, Kennedy had a much more romantic notion of a robed crusader for the rule of law. He liked to talk about the poetry of law and of great teaching cases, that is, opinions that instructed law students on timeless principles. Kennedy had been a judge for close to his whole professional life, since Gerald Ford made him the nation's youngest member of the Court of Appeals in 1975, when he was 39. Through his 12 years on the Ninth Circuit, and even in summers while he was a justice, Kennedy continued teaching at the McGeorge School of Law in his hometown of Sacramento. He saw law as not just a collection of cases, but a system that ought to be explainable to and understood by the next generation of lawyers. Kennedy was also a serious Catholic, of pre-Vatican II vintage, who went to Mass every Sunday and prayed in the old-fashioned manner, hands clasped before him. Abortion repelled him. He fully adopted his church's teachings on the subject. Once, before he joined the court, he had called Roe the Dred Scott of our time, a reference to the infamous 1857 ruling that sanctioned slavery and helped spark the Civil War. But Kennedy knew the difference between his duties as a judge and his convictions as a Catholic. As he once wrote, "The hard fact is that sometimes we must make decisions we do not like." Even though he and his church opposed abortion, that did not answer the question of whether the Constitution protected it. Kennedy's peculiar combination of traits, his earnestness and his ambition, his naivete and his grandiosity, his reverence for the law and his regard for his own talents, made him receptive to Souter's appeal. Kennedy thought there was nobility in judging. Saving Roe would show the world that the justices were something more than mere pawns. A statesmanlike compromise suited both Kennedy's politics and his conception of the role of a judge. So Kennedy signed on with Souter and O'Connor. His was the most dramatic switch of the three, because it had only been 3 years since he voted with Rehnquist in Webster, an opinion that advocated overruling Roe. Even more dramatically, Kennedy had clearly supported Rehnquist at the conference in Casey. No vote is ever final on the court until an opinion is announced, but changes from conference votes are still unusual, especially when, as in Casey, it was Kennedy's vote that allowed Rehnquist to start drafting his majority opinion. Nonetheless, in early May, Souter, O'Connor, and Kennedy decided to work together secretly on Casey, each of the justices telling only a single law clerk in their chambers that they were planning a joint opinion. Unaware of these machinations, the Chief Justice continued drafting what he expected would be the majority opinion. Writing with typical dispatch, Rehnquist circulated a draft on May 27th, just a little more than a month after the argument. According to the Chief, the court would uphold all of the provisions of the Pennsylvania law. Rehnquist wrote, "The court was mistaken in Roe when it classified a woman's decision to terminate her pregnancy as a fundamental right." If the chief's opinion won the support of a majority of justices, states would be free to regulate or even ban abortion altogether. As Blackmun wrote in the margin of the first page of Rehnquist's draft, "Wow, pretty extreme."